2 Corinthians chapter 11. I wish you would bear with me in a little foolishness. Do bear with me. For I feel a divine jealousy for you, since I betrothed you to one husband, to present you as a pure virgin to Christ. But I'm afraid that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes and proclaims another Jesus than the one we proclaimed, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or if you accept a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it readily enough. Indeed, I consider that I'm not in the least inferior to these super apostles. Even if I am unskilled in speaking, I'm not so in knowledge. Indeed, in every way we've made this plain to you in all things. Or did I commit a sin in humbling myself so that you might be exalted, because I preached God's gospel to you free of charge? I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. And when I was with you and was in need, I didn't burden anyone. For the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied my need. So I refrained, and I will refrain from burdening you in any way. As the truth of Christ is in me, this boasting of mine will not be silenced in the regions of Achaia. And why? Because I do not love you. God knows I do. And what I'm doing, I will continue to do in order to undermine the claim of those who would like to claim that in their boasted mission, they work on the same terms as we do. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So it's no surprise if his servants do also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Their end will correspond to their deeds. As we approach this chapter, let me ask you what you're most afraid of. What's your biggest fear? And I guess what you're most afraid of, your biggest fear, is related to what you think the worst thing that could happen would be. I've just been in New Zealand and Australia, both extremely frightening places, I think. So New Zealand's beautiful, and there's nothing poisonous there, but there's volcanoes everywhere. And almost these little hills in the middle of the city, and people say, oh yeah, that's a volcano, that's a volcano, that's a volcano. And my friend tried to reassure me by telling me that this particular volcano hadn't erupted for 900 years. I was like, that's quite recently, Robin. I thought you'd say it hadn't erupted for, you know, 50,000 years or something. But anyway, New Zealand, pretty frightening for volcanoes. Then I was in Australia. Australia's pretty frightening for almost anything that's alive can kill you. So spiders can kill you, snakes can kill you, sharks in the water can kill you. So pretty frightening things. But actually, as Christians, there's something worse than being caught in a volcano. And that would be fairly bad, wouldn't it, for a trip to New Zealand if you were there when a volcano erupted. There's something worse than that. There's something worse than being bitten by a poisonous snake in Australia. What is the thing that most frightens you? The thing that most frightens Paul is the possibility that these Christians in Corinth could lose their spiritual virginity, if I can put it that way. That's what he's very afraid about. Look at verse 3. I'm afraid, I am scared, that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. It's quite an amazing image here that we're pictured as people waiting for our wedding day. Now, some of us were there yesterday for Oliver and Lena's wedding, our first Grace Church Greenwich married couple, I think, so that was very exciting. And they're off on their honeymoon now today. But you know, lots and lots of preparations go into a wedding, and they've been looking forward to it for ages and meticulously planning everything. And Paul says, actually, the Christian life is like the run-up to a wedding. You're looking forward to it. It's going to be the most beautiful, stable, loving relationship that you could ever hope for. And we're going to be married, actually, not to, well, hopefully in some cases you'll be married to somebody in this life, but ultimately we're going to be married to one husband, to Christ. So this is an image that the Bible uses again and again of God's people as a bride and their God as our husband. It's an image that comes in the book of Isaiah. As a husband rejoices over his bride, so the Lord rejoices over you, says Isaiah. It's an idea that comes in the book of Ephesians. Famously, we often read it at weddings. It's this passage about wives and husbands. And then Paul surprisingly says, actually, I'm not talking just about human marriage. I'm actually talking about Christ and the church. It's quite a surprise, isn't it? For some people, I guess, they think that God is some aloof headmaster figure. God's role in the world is to tell you the rules and give you a detention if you break them. But the image that the Bible uses again and again of God's relationship with his people is not headmaster to school children, but husband to wife. Amazing, isn't it? The closest possible human relationship, intimacy, security, love. That's what he chooses as an image for what it will mean to know him forever. So the Christian life is a preparation for a wedding day. But here's Paul's real fear. How awful it would be if just before your wedding, you were seduced by somebody else. Imagine the embarrassment that the chauffeur turns up to take you to the church and rings on the doorbell and there's not an answer at first. And then you suddenly hurry down on the stairs, kind of grabbing your clothes and putting them on. And so does this other man. And that would be an awful thing, wouldn't it, on a wedding morning. And Paul says, that's what I'm scared about. I'm scared that spiritually you might jump into bed with somebody else before your wedding day. It's a shocking picture. I can see everyone's looking slightly shocked. It is shocking, isn't it? Because Paul says, look, I feel a jealousy for you. Now, I thought, thanks very much, David, for your little drama. I thought, what's going on here? Right before our eyes, there's going to be a marital bust-up in the middle of the front of church. But there's a difference, isn't there, between jealousy and envy. So envy is that sort of ugly thing that says, I want what that other person's got. So it's coveting. You know, I like their car more than my car, or I like their house more than my house, or I like their full head of hair more than my hair, or whatever it is that you're envious about. Envy is an ugly thing, but jealousy is the right thing. Jealousy means that you want to hold on to the thing that's yours. So to be jealous for your wife, she is my wife. She's not anyone else's. And Paul says, well, that's how I felt on Christ's behalf. You see, you're supposed to be his bride. You're preparing the way for this amazing wedding day, this future that every Christian looks forward to, of an eternity in a secure, permanent, loving relationship. How awful it would be, he thinks, if you were to lose your spiritual virginity just on the run-up to the wedding ceremony. That's the biggest fear. And actually, if we're sensible, that ought to be our greatest fear for one another. Even worse than being caught in a volcano. Some of you are going on holiday to New Zealand. You might want to watch them. Or even worse than being bitten by a snake or a spider. Be careful if you go to Australia. In fact, I lived in Australia 11 years ago, and I bought a spider identification chart because I thought, I know not many people die of spiders in Australia, but I think all of those who do are probably POMs, aren't they? Because we, you know, how do we know? They go to the hospital, they say, what kind of spider was it? I don't know. And then before you know it, you're dead. Even worse than that. Even worse than losing your job. Even worse than getting a diagnosis from the doctor that's cancer and it can't be treated. I mean, think of the worst fear that you have in this world. Paul says, no, this is what I'm afraid of. That before your wedding day, you might get seduced by someone else. See, if you die of cancer, you're still going to this wedding. That's the marvel, isn't it, of the resurrection of Jesus. I've got a friend at St. Helens who, this will probably be the last year of her life. She's my age. She's got terminal cancer. But, I mean, that's scary and horrible. But in a sense, it's okay. Because she's going to have a resurrection body. And she'll be there at the wedding day. For a permanent, secure, loving relationship with the Lord Jesus forever. She knows that, which is a great comfort to her in this year of chemo and and worsening health. If you die, but you're a Christian, then you're safe. But if something cuts in to turn you away from Jesus, then you're lost forever. And that's the really scary thing. Paul is scared. And he's scared because the thing that might seduce them is quite subtle. I wonder if you notice that. Look at verse 4. If someone comes and proclaims another Jesus than the one we proclaimed, or if you received a different spirit from the one you received, or if you accept a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it readily enough. See, here's the frightening thing. It's not as if in Corinth, you know, they're following Jesus and they've believed the Christian gospel, and along comes somebody from Corinth saying, oh no, you'd be much better off with Zeus. Why don't you give up following Jesus and start following Zeus? Because to be honest, not many of them are going to fall for that. Or in our day, similarly, if someone to come along and said, look, I know you've been a Christian for a while, but how about becoming a member of IS? Anyone? Anyone up for a bit of suicide bombing in exchange for a promise of a paradise full of virgins? I mean, honestly, it's not going to be that kind of thing that seduces us, is it? None of us is even remotely tempted to become a Muslim extremist or to become a Zeus follower. But actually, the teachers in Corinth are proclaiming, notice verse 4, they're proclaiming a Jesus. It's just he's another Jesus. And they're talking about a spirit, but it's a different spirit. And they're even proclaiming a gospel, but it's a different gospel. You see, the false teaching, it sounds like Christian teaching. It's about a message of good news. It's about the Holy Spirit. And it's about Jesus, it seems. Except that it's not. And that's why you might be seduced. He goes on to say, verse 13, at the end of the passage, about these false teachers, that they're deceitful and that they disguise themselves. So how can you tell a false teacher if they come to Grace Church Greenwich? Let's say we get a visiting speaker in next week. In fact, we have got a visiting speaker next week. I don't think he's a false teacher. He's a faithful guy that we know and trust and glad to have. But let's imagine Richard comes up next week. He's not going to wear a big T-shirt saying, I'm a false teacher. Because that would be far too obvious, wouldn't it? And he's probably not going to start his sermon by saying, oh, has anyone thought about following the Hindu god Vishnu? Because I really recommend it. No, the false teacher sounds like a real teacher. Because they disguise themselves. And no wonder, because even Satan, even the devil, disguises himself as an angel of light. So if he pretends to be telling the truth, it's no surprise that his followers do the same. So be careful, because you won't necessarily be able to tell. And Paul says, I'm scared. Wouldn't it be awful if you got turned off course? Now, it's very appropriate this. Yesterday at the wedding with Oliver and Lena, I met a friend of mine who I haven't seen for a while, who's a friend of theirs as well. They invited him to the wedding. And he's at Bible College at the moment, this friend of mine called Ben. And they've had a big controversy at their Bible College because they'd invited to speak at chapel the dean of the cathedral in Oxford. And it's sort of the thing that you do, that you invite the big dignitaries, and he's the big dignitary in the diocese. And so he was coming to chapel. But then it turned out that this guy, this dean, had published some essays in which he undermined the Christian teaching on marriage. Now, it can be anything, can't it? The issue can be different through the centuries. So in the first centuries, people were denying the divinity of Jesus. And then around the 16th century, people were denying that you could be forgiven simply by trusting Jesus. They said you had to add to that money paid into the coffers of the Vatican. And nowadays, the big debate is about homosexuality and who you're allowed to sleep with. And what the Bible says and what our culture says are really at odds with each other. And so there's great temptation and pressure to distort the Bible's teaching to match our culture. And this guy, the dean of Oxford Cathedral, Christ Church Cathedral, had published these essays undermining the traditional teaching of marriage. But he was invited to speak to the Bible College. Now, some of the guys training for ministry said, look, we can't have this guy coming to speak because he's denying what the Bible says. And in an attempt to kind of quieten it all down, I'm sad to say this is classic Anglicanism, in an attempt to quieten it all down, the principal said, no, but you shouldn't be so narrow. See, that's not, we shouldn't use the word false teacher of a dean in the Church of England. You know, he's a dean, for goodness sake. No, in the false teachers in the New Testament, they were really extreme people. They were the kind of people who were telling you that Jesus hadn't really come, or Jesus hadn't really been resurrected. But this guy's not saying that. You know, he's saying basically the same thing. So you guys throwing around the category of false teacher, you're just being very narrow, and you're being very bigoted, and surely we should be more generous, and so on and so forth. Now, it's very opposite. I said to him, thanks, this is my illustration. I am teaching 2 Corinthians 11 tomorrow. And this is exactly 2 Corinthians 11, isn't it? Because, of course, he's a dean, and he teaches the gospel, and he speaks about a Jesus. And no doubt he promises the inspiration of a spirit. But that's exactly what you've got to watch out for. What if it's a different gospel, and a different Jesus, and a different spirit? What if he's a counterfeit who looks like the real thing, but isn't the real thing? See, the false teaching that we'll get is always going to be the teaching from apparently Christian teachers. I remember the tragedy it was when a few years after graduating from university, we had a reunion. And I met a guy called Martin who'd been in the Christian Union with me and been really keen. And I talked to him, and just as I was chatting to him, I thought something's a bit different, something's a bit wrong. And he said, oh, Andrew, yeah, I should explain. I don't really believe quite the same things that I used to when we were so radical as students in Cambridge. Oh, no, I mean, I'm still going to church. It's just, you know, my church likes to take things a little bit more lightly, a little bit more broadly. And my heart sank, and I was afraid. Turns out that in every single book of the New Testament, bar two, false teaching is a major concern. I think 1 Peter and Philemon are the only two exceptions. In every other book of the New Testament, there is a warning about this. So Jesus expects it. In fact, Jesus called them wolves in sheep's clothing. And the point of sheep's clothing is that you look like a sheep. No one's going to be seduced by wolves in wolves' clothing. But they are disguised. Now, there's great pressure, as you know, in the Church of England to say, look, let's be broad. I've always found that quite a puzzling adjective to celebrate, haven't you? The Church of England is a broad church, people say. Because Jesus used the adjective broad, I think, about two things, neither of which were particularly positive. Remember, he talked about a broad gate and a broad road, and it leads to destruction, he says. And then Jesus spoke about the adjective narrow, which people dislike so much, and he said, oh, there's a narrow gate and a narrow road, and it leads to life. I'm always slightly puzzled when people think that broad is a good thing. They obviously haven't read the words of Jesus. But, you know, there is a real pressure on us in our age just to be generous. And actually, we oughtn't confuse humility and uncertainty. Sometimes people say, well, to be so sure, to be so narrow, that's to be arrogant. It needn't be arrogant. It might just be that we're sure because God said. It's possible to be humbly sure and humbly narrow. And breadth and generosity, it could be very dangerous. Be careful, says Paul. I'm afraid that you might lose your spiritual virginity. And beware, because the false teachers are going to look very like the true ones. And actually, he then goes on to say that you need to be extra careful, because the false teachers, well, they draw you in and they trick you because of the way that they behave. So just look at verse 5. And just in the few verses that follow, we'll see some of the tricks of the false teachers that get people to follow them. So verse 5, indeed, Paul says, I consider I'm not in the least inferior to these super apostles. That's probably, by the way, his ironic title. I don't suppose they actually call themselves. You've heard of Paul the Apostle. I'm Andrew the super apostle. I think he's being ironic. He's giving them this flashy title. But I don't consider myself inferior to them, even if I am unskilled in speaking. I'm not saying knowledge. See, this is a little hint that these guys, they are the fantastic preachers. They're the people who can fill the stadiums. And they're the people who can have people laugh. I'm actually reassured that I'm not very funny and you're not laughing today. Oh, thanks so much. But bother, that sort of refuted the point, didn't it? The speakers who can make people laugh. Oh, he's such a funny preacher. He's such a talented preacher. He's such a powerful preacher. And people come to hear them. And Paul, he's not very skilled in speaking. So he doesn't have the great rhetoric. He doesn't have everyone laughing. People don't admire him for his turn of phrase. He says, it doesn't mean that I didn't have the knowledge. I told you what was true. But the danger is that you'll fall for the people who say what's impressive. It's quite interesting, you can do this study. What causes people outside church to say, thanks, that was a good sermon? And I find it slightly chilling that I've been in sermons that were awful but funny, or were awful and very skilled, because the guy's just excellent as a speaker. But what he said was false. And I've also been in sermons that are pretty dry and average, but true and faithful. And maybe courageously say things that are from the Bible that we need. And I wonder which of those members of Grace Church Greenwich would leave church saying, oh, what a great sermon. Because just beware. I remember it's very awkward. Someone turns to you and says, wasn't that a great sermon? You're thinking, no, it was an awful sermon. Because it was untrue. I run a little preaching group to help people who are starting out preaching and learning how to preach. And I always say that there's two things that you need. One of them is accuracy, so that you get the Bible text right. And the second thing you need is communication, so you get it across. And ideally, you want both. So you want accuracy, you get the Bible right, and you want communication so people can hear it. But if you had to choose between the two, it's much, much better to be accurate but not very good at speaking than to be good at speaking but false. The worst combo is the false teacher who is an excellent speaker. One of the great encouragements about some of the worst false teaching in biblical studies is it was written in German, and not many people understood it in the last 100 years. But beware the false teaching that is in the stadiums from the popular preachers that everyone loves. It will get you. Paul says, I wasn't skilled in speaking, but I told you the truth. And then verse 7, you'll see another clue to what's going on. Verse 7, or did I commit a sin in humbling myself to you so that you might be exalted because I preach God's gospel to you free of charge? Seems what's going on is these false teachers in Corinth, they charged. So they said, well, look, you're very lucky to have me today in Grace Church Greenwich. And do you realize I'm actually quite an important speaker? So I hope you won't mind that on the door I'll be asking for a £10 fee. It's like I've even heard a friend of mine was going speaking in the States, and we've got some American friends here, but he went to a big conference and they asked him if there's anything he wanted in his green room. You know, the pops, is it called that, or blue room or something? You know, the room off stage where you got all your stuff, and some pops thing is Justin Bieber says, oh, I want it to be filled with this particular kind of chocolate or whatever. And they ask a Christian preacher, is anything he wanted in his green room? He's like, what? You know, what is going on? Anyway, but that's the danger, isn't it? The big conference, the big headline. And these guys in Corinth, they charge. They said, oh, yeah, I've got certain requirements for my green room. And if I come to speak for you, I'll be needing to stay in the best hotel. And I'll be expecting this as my standard honorarium. And because they were so expensive, people thought they must be really good. It's one of the great tricks, isn't it, that marketing people learn. Sometimes you double the cost and the sales go up. because people think this must be something really worth having. And Paul, conversely, when he went to Corinth, he didn't charge. Now, obviously, he had to have money to live on. So he got the money to live on because other churches supported him. So he had missionary supporters from where he come from in Macedonia. And sometimes he worked himself. Actually, he, out of his love for them, he didn't want to make a charge for the gospel. It's one of the reasons why when we have guest services, we don't have a collection or we don't mention our finances. Of course, we need finances as a church, but we don't want unbelievers to think, come to Grace Church Greenwich because we want your money. Come to the church and here's the tin rattling. Make sure you make a contribution, won't you? By the way, if you're here today as a guest, we don't want your money. But because Paul didn't want their money, they thought, oh no, he mustn't be as important as these very expensive teachers, you see? So they were great speakers, and they're very expensive. And also that they were very proud. They gave you all their qualifications. And verse 12, that they are described as those who would like to claim in their boasted mission that they work on the same terms as we do. Oh, we're just like the Apostle Paul, they say. Yeah, he went, you've heard about his missionary journeys. Well, let me tell you about ours. You've heard about his great sermons. Let me tell you about my great sermon. Have I told you about the books I've read? Please do check them on the bookstall. You'll be able to get them there. Let me just emphasize just how important my ministry is. And yet, Paul says, they're fakes. You can't tell just by their preaching style. You can't tell by their expense. You can't tell by their claims. You can tell, verse 15, by their deeds. It's no surprise if Satan's servants disguise themselves as servant of righteousness, their end will correspond to their deeds. You see, in the end, God knows whether a teacher is faithful or false. And God knows the lifestyle of that preacher and whether it's faithful or false. And God isn't going to be mocked or deceived on the last day. So, message to Grace Church Greenwich. Be careful. The worst thing that could happen to any of us in our life is that we get led astray. If one of you comes to me and says, Andrew, I've had bad news from the doctor, I've got cancer, I'll be a bit sad. But I'll think, thank goodness you're a Christian and you're safe on the last day. If one of you comes to me and says, oh, Andrew, I've lost my job, or I can't get another job, I'll be a bit sad. I think, oh, it's good that you're a Christian and they've got a Heavenly Father who cares for you. But if one of you comes along and says, oh, Andrew, I no longer think that I need to be quite as narrow as some of the things that we said in Corinthians, and surely we can be a bit more generous. And I heard this other preacher, and he seemed like a nice guy, and he had lots of degrees. And I mean, he said that we didn't have to take what the Bible said so seriously, but he seemed like a jolly good guy. Then I'll be very scared. And I hope we'll have that sort of fear for one another, the thing that we most fear. Because we're heading for a great wedding day. A permanent, secure relationship that will last forever in a perfect new world. And wouldn't it be awful if we lost our spiritual virginity before that day? So be careful. Don't judge a preacher just by his rhetoric, or by how funny he is, or how expensive he is, or how good he says he is. But check whether he's faithful. Don't be fooled just because he tells you about a gospel and a Jesus and a spirit. Is it the same spirit or a different spirit? The same gospel, a different gospel? Is it the same Jesus or another Jesus? And let's make sure that we're careful to stay by the words of this book, narrow as they are, unpopular as they're going to be in the Church of England in our generation, and in the United Kingdom in the context in which we live. But hold on, because it's a wedding day ahead. It's going to be a great, great day.